Resident Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour. We have a great show for you tonight, as we mentioned last week, which was on the 12th or the 13th, depending on what part of the country you're in. In fact, today is the 19th. On the West Coast, and the 20th on the East Coast already, and in the Central Time Zone. We had determined that we were going to feature Jim Murray's Dynaflux Generator. We've been talking about power, alternative energy devices, and we spent the last 2 weeks talking about water. And, of course, we go off on tangents, as usual, when you start talking about how the government intrudes, and we're speaking of government in the smallest sense these days, the lowest vibration possible in the universe. So I use that word with great reservation. There are obviously many advanced technologies that are being withheld from the majority of humanity and used for alternative purposes, such as money laundering and the poisoning of our ecosystem. Of course, a lot of it's spent in underground bases and tunnels, and then we have what goes on up in space. And while all this is going on, they create wars over oil, which is next to what goes down your sewer, particularly out of your bathroom, and yet they make billions and billions and billions of dollars every year, and nobody seems to want to change it. Tonight we're going to talk about an alternative that can empower individuals and companies alike around the world. This invention was created by tonight's guest, who is a scientist, an inventor, an author, a lecturer, and a teacher, and he is our regular Friday night guest on Evident Footprints, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show tonight.
Hey, Don. Thank you. It's good to be here as usual. How are you tonight?
I'm doing great. Had a busy day today, just with all the madness of journalism, if you know what I mean, getting stuff posted on my website. So to answer your question, you know, I'm here and I'm looking forward to the show tonight. It'll be a nice relief from what I've been doing all day.
Well, good. I hope so. I've given a lot of thought to the show too, and with your permission, rather than just jump in and get into the complexities of power generation, I thought it might make more sense, since I don't think we've discussed this topic since you've been with this this particular show, might make more sense to backtrack a little bit and discuss the interesting series of events that led up to the discovery of this technology, and then proceed into it in more depth after the fact, if that's okay with you.
Sure, that's fine. We can touch on any topic you like. Although somewhere along the lines we got to talk about your generator, so.
Well, that's not a problem. Okay. But I did think it would be kind of neat to set the stage for that whole thing rather than just jump into it.
Okay.
And of course, that necessitates turning the clock back a little bit and discussing, at least to some extent, my earlier life and how I got involved in all this stuff and. I know you've heard this before, but I thought it might be interesting for the folks who haven't heard it to recap some of that and then lead from there into the topic of the main discussion.
Okay, that'd be fine. Is it okay if I take a nap during this portion? No, I'm just kidding. Just kidding, I won't.
I've hosted your show before. Don, you can step out if you want.
No, it's okay. I'm just being crazy.
Well, anyway, just so that the folks know, when I was a younger guy, I studied college physics in high school, and my real aim in life was to dedicate my energies to high-energy particle physics. And in that regard, I was totally hooked on the design and experimentation associated with particle accelerators. And I got bitten by this bug very early on. I think I was in the sixth or seventh grade when I really got the bug. And by the time I was in high school, I was designing and building small particle accelerators. And I won all kinds of awards in the National Science Talent Search and other things of that sort. So I thought I was really headed for a career in that field. And then, of course, a whole series of events occurred in my senior year, which I would never have anticipated. And that they basically started off with my dad's sudden death. And after I graduated, instead of going to MIT like I thought I was going to do, I wound up attending night school in Jersey City. And one of the first things that began to stir my innermost feelings was that in the library in that small city college, I found some very rare books on Nikola Tesla. And I had heard of Tesla before, but I never gave any particular thought to how much of a genius the guy was until I started reading some of the more unusual reports about the technologies he was trying to foster as far back as, you know, the early 1900s. And that really set me thinking about whether I was more interested in trying to figure out what he was doing or whether I wanted to smash atoms for a living. But an experience came along from a totally unexpected direction, which really set the stage for my entire life. And believe it or not, it had to do with a gift that was given to me by a gal I was dating at the time, and it was a book called They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers. And in this book, they covered a whole thing about the whole flying saucer mystery and a lot of the stuff that was going on, and they interviewed various people who had exposure to this concept. And there was one guy in there who very dogmatically said that he knew a great deal about the saucer situation and he was willing to talk about it with anybody. And he gave his name and his address, which I thought was an extraordinary thing to do in the first place, considering the nature of the topic. But more astounding was the fact that he was living in the same city as me. And the gentleman's name was Dominic Lucchesi, and he was living on the north side of Jersey City, and I was living approximately midtown, and it wasn't that far away. And so I befriended this gentleman, and he proceeded to open my eyes to a whole world that I never knew existed, having to do with UFOs and all these fantastic things. But one day, he introduced me to something which really, really struck home. He brought out of his files a very beautifully and professionally prepared prospectus, corporate prospectus, having to do with a company called OTC Enterprises. And I was flabbergasted to find that here was an actual corporation centered in Baltimore, Maryland, and endeavoring to produce UFOs, or more properly termed paragravitic or anti-gravity type vehicles for home use, for use as vehicles by the common man. And the hopes were, was that these would replace automobiles and trucks and things of that sort. And the thing was so well laid out and very expensive. You could tell just by looking at it. I was really taken back by it, and I asked Dominic, I said, well, what's the story with this guy? I said, nobody goes through all this trouble and prints all this stuff up and then just disappears. And he said, well, that's exactly what he did. He disappeared. And he proceeded to tell me what he knew about this guy, Otis Carr. Well, the thing that was intriguing, of course, was Dominic was familiar enough with Carr's background that he related the story to me concerning where Carr supposedly got the information to design and build these anti-gravity vehicles. And as the legend goes, he was working his way through school in Brooklyn and had, for the sake of earning money, he was operating as a night clerk in the Pennsylvania Hotel in New York City. And at that same time, Nikola Tesla happened to be living there. And the story goes that he was asked to deliver these bags of bird seed up to Tesla's suite on a number of occasions because, as you know, Tesla had the strange habit of feeding pigeons in the middle of the night. And Carr became intrigued with this guy, this mysterious man who lived in the, you know, the upper part of the hotel, had a big suite up there. And supposedly they eventually became friends, and Tesla entrusted information to him in one way or another, which many years later led to the development of OTC Enterprises. Now, for a kid that is absolutely hooked on physics and was about, 18 or 19 at the time, that was an absolutely incredible story and something that I couldn't get out of my mind. So even though I was engaged in further studies in night school, I found myself digging more and more into this mystery. And with the help of Mr. Lucchesi, I was eventually introduced to a character from Connecticut who was endeavoring to build an electric car. And this guy's name was Gene Carini. And as it turned out, and I don't know if this is serendipitous or if it's fate or call it what you will, but this guy, Gene Carini, had been Otis Carr's electronics technician and had worked with him for several years building the OTC X1 craft, which was tested in all places, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, where I live now. So as you can see, it's already becoming a very convoluted and interesting story, but I'll try to shorten it because I could take up several programs with this information, as you well know.
Mm-hmm.
But as fate would have it, after having met Carini and talked with him, he invited me to join his company and help him build this electric car. The electric car was operating on a drive principle, which I later learned was a sort of a subset of the technology used to propel the OTC X1 craft. And so as all this stuff began to unfold, I became more and more intrigued with the whole thing, and I was absolutely determined to find out how all this really related back to Tesla, if it did. And if so, you know, what was the meat of this technology? What kind of technological innovations were hiding in this strange sequence of events that supposedly propagated from this great genius? And why was it residing in the hands of these strange individuals who were building offbeat machinery in secret places? So anyway, I stayed with Carini for about 2 years before his company went bankrupt. But during that period of time, I was then introduced to an even more extraordinary character by the name of Warren Goetz. And Goetz lived way up in the northern peninsula of Michigan. And his claim to fame was that he was building a 32-foot spaceship in a secret hangar based on Lake Huron. And I learned this through Carini, and eventually, after Carini retired and went down to Florida, the temptation was just too much, so I went on up to Michigan, met this guy, and got involved with building this huge spaceship in a hangar up there, just as I said. And I wound up spending 7 years in Michigan in the northern peninsula. Goetz's situation wound up luring me there, but after I was up there and got familiar with the area, I wound up being hired by Bethlehem Steel as the electrical foreman on Drummond Island. And Drummond Island is a very intriguing place. And they had a huge installation there involving the mining of dolomite, which they used to sinter blast furnaces. And it was while I was working for Bethlehem Steel that I got involved with the actual hardcore technology which led to the discovery of Dynaflux. And the way that happened was kind of interesting because there was an old Bucyrus Erie electric shovel that they used to use in ripping rock in the mine up there, and they decided to junk it. And the machinery in it was so beautiful. I went and I asked the foreman, the head guy in the place, not to scrap the internal workings, but to let me have that. And I lugged it all out of the shovel and brought it into our electric shop. And over the next period of about 6 or 8 months, I revamped everything, rebuilt everything, all the high voltage switches, you know, the motor generator set and all the controls. And over the course of the next 3 years, we built an entire building in which we installed this equipment. And I built essentially a device called the synchronous capacitor, which I then used to offset the demand of the entire plant. And it dropped their electric bill so significantly that the local power company thought we had bypassed their meters. So needless to say, that device was a big hit. And during the course of testing it and playing with it, I learned a lot of very interesting things. And as you know, this interesting story, I schemed up an idea to test Tesla's concept of energy resonance and power oscillation by using the synchronous capacitor as a reflection device for the local power company's standby generators. And one night, one dark, stormy night in November, when the lines went down between Detour and Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, I got over there in my little generating station on the Drummond Island side, and my assistant, who actually ran the Detour generating station, put his equipment online. And I had altered my normal arrangement to cause this oscillation to occur. And during that time period, we had all sorts of incredible and very mysterious things happening in the town. The Christmas decorations were exploding, and the lights were going on and off, and people's TVs were acting very mysteriously, et cetera, et cetera. And at the height of the experiment, when the diesels were moaning and groaning, and everything was reacting in very unpredictable ways. Just as we reached the point where we started to notice the effects of this incredible form of resonance, the load suddenly went off the diesels, and we reached this amazing state where even though they were running, they had no load on them, and the whole town was still lit up, so was the mine, and it was very mysterious, and I was just so excited at this point and ready to explore it further, but unfortunately the electrical strain was so incredibly high that it blew the cable head on the island, and the whole town and everything went dark. So luckily that was blamed on lightning. But that whole experience left me so entrenched in this incredible mode of discovery and investigation regarding the oscillation of power and what this new form of resonance could do, that I was thinking about it incessantly. And then I don't think it was more than maybe 3 or 4 weeks later that I had gone into the little workshop that I had over in Detour, and it was real early one morning, and I had just had breakfast, and I was waiting for the heater to come up, and I had this incredible vision while I was watching the sunrise, and just in that instant, I understood on some level how it was possible to set up a miniature, what actually turns out to be like a miniature version of the combination of the generating station and the synchronous capacitor and the forces that were acting between them in such a way that this all could be embodied in a single electromagnetic device. And I built this generator, put it on the bench, and started testing it, and that was the beginning of a whole series of incredible discoveries and investigations which have consumed the majority of my life. Because I was actually 19 when I went to work for Perini, and I'm now 61. So you can just imagine what has transpired in those intervening years, Don.
Mm-hmm. Your mention of Otis Carr stimulated something, let's say, in my discernment, and we're going to have to talk about that sometime. We can do a whole show on what came through while you were talking about that.
Well, I'm happy to follow up on it. No problem.
Yeah, we had mentioned, just for the listening audience, that Otis Carr seems like a someone very unlikely to run into Tesla. And every time you tell this story, I pick up a couple more bits of information, and combining it with my research, I'm convinced that there's something much more to Mr. Carr than one would have thought, we'll say. But the purpose
You could certainly be right about that, because as you know, I eventually located Carr and had quite a session with him. And it was just a short time before he died. He died of a massive cerebral hemorrhage, which is kind of unusual considering that the guy was not exactly, well, let's put it this way. He was a fairly sedate individual who kept to himself. And, you know, you wouldn't think he'd be under any unusual stress. But anyway, the reason I say that there might be something to that, it's because of the fact that when I met him, he was one of the most paranoid people that I ever met in my life. I mean, he was even paranoid about discussing his technologies in front of his own wife, which was really bizarre. He talked about the fact that he had been jailed. He talked about the fact that his technologies had been suppressed and stolen, and gave me a lot of information about how he fit into the other characters that that I had met along the way, like his relationship with Carini, how he fits in, how his technology fit into the entire Getz scenario, and most importantly, he talked about the whole thing with Nikola Tesla. But in one of the tapes that Carini eventually let me listen to, where he had taped an interview between himself and Otis Carr back in the 50s when he first met Carr in Baltimore, the most extraordinary tidbit of information came out, and I'll never, ever forget it as long as I live because it was so striking. Carini was asking Carr to describe, first of all, he asked him, had he ever been into Tesla's suite in the Pennsylvania Hotel? And he said, oh, yeah, many times. And he asked him to please describe how Tesla lived in that quarters. And Carr went into a greatly detailed explanation of Tesla's living quarters. He talked about the fact that there was a huge mahogany desk over by the two-front windows, and there were all these reference books and everything always open on the desk and pads with calculations and stuff. And then he said the room was lined with bookcases all the way around and books on every conceivable subject. And on top of each bookcase were miniature models of his greatest inventions. And on the walls were architectural renderings of his Wardenclyffe Tower and various turbines and the Niagara Project and all these other things that he was endeavoring to do in his life. And in the midst of describing all this stuff, then he said there was a big reference table over against the far wall, and on that table was a series of books and manuscripts and notebooks and all this stuff. And out of the clear blue sky, totally unprompted, he said, "But I never stole anything." And I couldn't believe that. I played that back a dozen times, and I just couldn't believe that he said that. And the reason why this is significant is because in this whole mystery having to do with Carr's attempt to build flying saucers and then Warren Getz's attempt to do the same thing, Carini's attempt to build electric cars powered by unknown energy sources, and all this stuff, all these things relate back to this mysterious blue notebook. Now, I first heard about the notebook through Carini. Carini said Carr had it all the time, and he referenced it constantly. Then I found out later on the notebook was eventually stolen from Carr by Getz, and Getz then had this notebook, and I actually got to see it. He never let me look at it, but I sat right next to him at his own dining room table, and I could look diagonally across and see, you know, the writing, the equations, the sketches, the diagrams, and all that kind of stuff. So I know the book existed. I saw it myself. So in conjunction with the things that you are saying, it leads one to wonder if young Otis Carr did swipe a notebook from Tesla, and if he did, was this done at his own volition? Or was he prompted to do something of this sort by someone else? And I think that's where you were going with it, isn't it, Don?
Yes. If you recall a statement I made, this was when we had a similar conversation, not this exact same conversation, of course. We were talking about my research and the fact that we had discovered that George H. Scherf was actually George, and I'm saying Junior, was actually George H.W. Bush, and that he had been trained and sent by Adolf Hitler to spy on Tesla. Now, there came a time, and I'm wondering, before I go on anymore, I was going to ask you a question. This popped into my head three times. Do you know about the year or the general time period that that car would have been with Tesla?
Yeah, I do. Approximately 1926.
Okay, this is what he told you?
I have to be honest with you. I don't remember specifically who may or may not have told me that, but I'm pretty sure that if you check the record, Tesla was living at the Pennsylvania Hotel during that time period.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know the busboy there at the restaurant. I know the maitre d' and the concierge. Maybe I'll ask them if they can look up the record. I'm being a bit crazy. The reason I bring this up, we talked about my research, and I was making the connection between Prescott Bush and George H. Scherf Sr. being the same person. And it seemed to me that they were always able to be separate from each other, yet I knew that there was a connection to the Rockefellers and to the Union Banking Corporation via Union Sulphur, where George H. Scherf Sr. worked. And I was poring through patents, and I came across a Tesla type of invention that was, I'm going to say it was renamed. I don't think Tesla would create anything and call it an illumination controller. But I looked at the patent, and it looked like a movie projector and a TV, which would have been like the first VCR TV combo in existence. And this was a patent that was applied for, if I remember correctly, it was applied for in 1914, and the patent was granted in 1917. And you had mentioned, when we talked about this on the show, I don't know if you recall this, but you had mentioned that Otis Carr was studying in Brooklyn, which
right.
You just mentioned. And he was an art student. And I had remarked that the invention, which I suspected would have been co-signed with Hermann Frosch, who was the president of Union Sulphur, and someone who could advise Scherf, who had applied for the patent on what the device would be worth, and maybe it was a co-venture, and they probably made an arrangement with Otis Carr to do the drawing. And I, as if I've ever had a hunch, that hunch is still alive and well and breathing heavily. Right now it's panting. And because of the nature of the drawing, it was nothing typical of Tesla. Now you could say, well, it wasn't a Tesla invention. How the heck did Scherf get his hands on such a device? How did Scherf come up with an explanation, which really the explanation was reworded also? I'm sure that the name of the invention, the wording of how it worked, you know, the general description in the application as to what it is and how it works, and it's a totally new invention, and then the drawing being very amateurish, nothing like the professional draftsmanship that I had seen in hundreds of Tesla's patents. And then I did more digging, and I found that this was registered and being sold under the George H. Scherf Company. And guess where that was? Brooklyn. New York.
Right.
Brooklyn, New York. Now, that said, and I don't mean to be long-winded here, but I'm explaining this so the listening audience can get an image of this. Scherf would have been very well known to Tesla at that time, and there was, I'm sure there were falling outs over a period of time. It very well may be that Otis Carr was sent there, let's say after graduation from school, or maybe he never finished the school. I don't know, but I suspect that he was sent there to be an agent to take over George H. Scherf Jr., Jr.'s position, that being George H.W. Bush, and continue where he had left off. Because if you remember, Tesla saw him as a pest when he was a teenager, and the story Curious George was Tesla's idea that character be developed into a cartoon, which it was, because he just couldn't stand him. He was always pouring through his things, spying, stealing things whenever he could. And you know, Tesla, being who he was sort of tolerant, but also very angry and upset with that situation. Isn't it interesting, too, that when the Air Force, who was acting as the front man for the military, was doing reports after they had Project Grudge, and supposedly that was wrapped up, then they had Project Blue Book. Do you think that was a coincidence, or do you think it had everything to do with Tesla's blue notebook?
I don't know, but that's a pretty interesting thing, because Project Blue Book, you know, had everything to do with the early UFO investigations, and it may well be that, you know, that was all eyewash, and that they already knew full well what these crafts were all about, and this mm-hmm. was just, you know, a gesture, if you will, to placate the troubled public. But they were already light years ahead of all of that, if that's the case.
Oh yeah, I think maybe they named it just, you know, almost as a practical joke, is what I'm saying. Because Project Blue Book was about UFOs.
Yeah, I know.
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say the proximity to Washington, D.C., being in Baltimore, is kind of coincidental. Gene Carini being in Connecticut, that's where the Bushes were. They were in New Haven.
Well, anything is possible. Although, I'd be honest with you, I knew Carini better than I know some of my family members. And I'm saying that the combination of admiration and you know, and as yeah. well as respect. And I just can't envision him knowingly being involved in something of that sort.
Oh, I'm not implying. I'm not implying he would be, but I'm just saying their proximity. They very likely could have known something without him knowing.
Sure, that's entirely possible. And don't forget, the most amazing thing of all was when I left Carini. And someday when I write a book about all this, it'll be a lot clearer. But in the closing days of the whole episode with Carini, things were falling apart very rapidly in his organization. He had some really weird people working for him at that time. And the thing went from bad to worse almost overnight. This one guy that was supposedly his corporate treasurer embezzled $50,000, and then the company president caught him in the act, and you know, one thing led to another, and there was all this internal commotion. And at that point, I thought, well, you know, this is a great time for me to go back to college, because I could see there was nothing else going to happen here. Carini had secretly told me that, you know, if anything went wrong, he was going to go to Florida and retire, and so I just bowed out basically and went back to New Jersey. I found out that within 3 or 4 days after me leaving, the research facility that we used to call the car barn, which was actually behind the machine shop where I did all my prototyping and everything, was firebombed in the middle of the night. And the building burned completely to the ground, and 5 electric car prototypes and an electric motorcycle were all destroyed. And I think that that's pretty far out to happen in a little tiny town of Bolton, Connecticut, you know, with people working on electric cars, which I have to tell you, were very primitive and didn't really respond the way Carini thought they should. And they never got to the bottom of who set the blaze. But for the building to be so totally destroyed, and for all of the vehicles to be, you know, just about disintegrated, there had to be a very exceptional accelerant involved. And it just seems very strange to me that somebody would go through all that trouble because there was an eccentric guy tinkering with electric cars, you know, in the early, late 1960s. It just didn't make any sense.
And, probably the same people that burned Tesla's lab down.
Well, anything is possible. But, you know, the strange thing about it is, while I was actually living through this maze as part of my younger life, I had no idea that there was all this intrigue. I didn't really put it together until I actually met Carr himself. And he told me the story about his attempt to hire Warren Goetz. And what's interesting about Goetz, Goetz was actually a radar officer in the United States Army, or the Army Air Corps. And he had been discharged on a Section 8, which isn't necessarily a good thing. And when he came and applied for to be hired by Otis Carr in his Apple Valley, California establishment, he was intending to sign on as an electronics technician to replace Carini. Because Carini had left Carr after the failure of the test flight of the OTC-X2 or whatever it was here in Oklahoma City. And he had basically gone back to TV repair, which he, you know, had been doing for quite a few years previously. And it's also interesting that Goetz would have been coming out of the Army of all places, you know, to apply as a electronics technician to Otis Carr. But Carr investigated him, and his superior officer said that he had been released on a Section 8, and so he didn't hire him. Well, mysteriously, that same night or the next night, Carr's lab was broken into, and what was stolen? Three things. The blue notebook, an 18-inch, very professionally rendered model of the OTC-X2 spaceship, and a power Utron unit, which was supposedly functional. Mm-hmm. And Carr always suspected that it was Goetz. And by the time that I met Carr, I had already known Goetz for quite some time, and I had seen the Utron demonstration, and I had never seen the miniature craft. Although Goetz talked about it openly, and of course I sat right at his table and saw the blue notebook hundreds of times. So it's a really mysterious and interesting story, and you know, I didn't even have a clue as to how involved it was while I was going through it. I only realized it in retrospect when I started trying to piece all the fragments together into something coherent. And it looks like it's still being put together, you know, with the information you're coming up with.
Well, again, I'm repeating something I mentioned the last time you and I talked about this. The only other time I've ever heard anyone mention the Utron unit was when Otto Skorzeny disclosed that he and Reinhard Galen each stole one each of three that were on the ship during the Philadelphia experiment, which had gone awry. He described stealing one and Reinhard Galen picking up one. He said they weighed between 70 and 80 pounds, so they could only carry one each. And they got those to Germany. Smuggled them to Germany.
Did he describe the unit in any detail?
No, but he called it a Utron. He said after the Philadelphia experiment went bad, he basically said they were spying, watching the whole thing. And I don't know if they were taking photographs or just waiting for an opportunity, but when all the chaos hit, they went on the ship and stole the two units. Interesting that you should mention that. Very interesting. And again, I would make the connection to the aforementioned individual.
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting because, you know, Carr himself had produced, when you know, there's things we don't know about Carr, and I wish I had asked him when I did meet him. The most mysterious thing is how he went from having a multi-million dollar corporation with all these highfalutin individuals involved, and then suddenly he's more or less ousted and starts going on personal campaigns to regenerate his company, and each endeavor, you know, was worse than the previous one until finally, after the Oklahoma scenario, I understand that he was almost thrown out of Oklahoma on account of the explosion and all the other things that went wrong with his demonstration. And then he tried to start up again in Apple Valley, California, and at that point, I believe it was one of the attorneys general who basically brought charges against him for stock fraud. And he spent quite a bit of time in jail, I don't know how many years. But anyway, it's a very strange thing, you know, to see this almost an exponential decay of his involvement in all this stuff, and then he winds up as a totally obscure individual, you know, tucked away in an old age home in Pittsburgh, which is where I found him. And, you know, he used to talk about the fact that in the early days when he was in Baltimore, that there were these big companies who had actually tested the Utron power packs and some of the thrusters for the, you know, the electromagnetic thrusters for the ship, and that they came back with astonishing results and this and that and the other thing. And he was promised all kinds of money, and then that never happened. Then all of a sudden, OTC Enterprises just disappeared. You know,
it was funded by the government, likely, I would say.
Well, it's very possible. I tried to do a patent search on some of Carr's earlier applications just to see if there had been, you know, a series of patents submitted or patent applications submitted and this and that. And strangely enough, the only one that came out of the whole thing was the amusement ride, which wound up in Frontier City in Oklahoma, a Flying Saucer amusement park ride. And I had heard about that before from Carini, and I remember asking Gene, I said, well, what kind of shenanigans is that? You know, why would you want to go and patent an amusement park ride when you supposedly had spent many years and millions of dollars trying to perfect a real ship? And he said, well, he said, you know, something went wrong in the corporation. He said, I don't know exactly what it was, but he said, what I got out of it was that the Carr had applied for this amusement park patent to hide information in the public domain, which somebody might be able to use later on, because he was prevented from using his own information. And his earlier patents that he applied for were supposedly never granted. They were taken into the government as national security, you know, under the National Security Clause. And there may be some truth to that, because when I tried to find earlier patents, there were things which my patent attorney said, well, they're just, it looks like there was something there, but it's not available. And I said, well, what does that mean? What the heck does that mean? And he goes, I'm not sure what it means. And that's all the more I ever got out of it.
I heard at one point that he had actually approached General Motors about some seed capital for this thing, for this project. It may have been when he went to Apple Valley that occurred. And then it was shortly afterwards they were building this craft out in the open. It wasn't even inside a building. It was just anybody could fly over the area and see exactly what they were doing.
Well, that must have been at the time when just before he went to prison, when what's that gentleman's name that was from Las Vegas that we used to talk about?
Ralph Ring. Yes.
Supposedly, Ralph Ring then got the position that Getz had applied for. And what happened from that time on, I have no idea, because I didn't know anybody in that circle until many, many years later when I met Ralph Ring in Las Vegas. So I can't tell you too much about that side of it. Mm-hmm. But as far as seeing the original, some of the original plans and stuff like that, I can tell you quite a bit about that. One other thing that he tried to do to get the information out to the public was he actually took an entire set of plans for the OTCX1 and literally reduced them down to, I believe they were like 18 by 24 inch drawings, along with a whole bunch of theoretical explanations and this and that and the other thing. And there was 20-30 sheets of paper in that stack, and then they were rolled up and put in cardboard tubes, and I think they were selling for like $75, back in, I don't remember what year, but let's say around the mid-60s type time period. And I had the opportunity to investigate one of those things, and the problem with it was there was really nothing in there that you could ever get your teeth into. And yet, if you ignored the writing, the written part of it, and you looked at the diagrams, some of it was extraordinary stuff, particularly the way in which the utrons were employed. And then there were drawings that showed the various views of the utron figure itself. And the thing that's interesting about the utron, if you look at it directly down from a pole piece on the top, it looks like a circle. If you hold it with the axis at 45 degrees and you look at it from the side, it looks like a square. And if you then tip the axis at 45 degrees the way it normally would be used, and you look at it from the top, it looks like an oval. And according to what Carr was teaching, this unique geometry was the result of understanding Einsteinian space folding, or what did he call it? Space-time geometry, and resulted in a shape which was capable of producing, incredible energy related effects.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I examined several utrons of a very small ones, about the size of an orange, and some of them had coils wound on them, some of them did not. Some of them were hollow, some were not. Some of them were in gimbals and set to move through a magnetic field. So that whatever the shape was supposed to be, there were several different arrangements that you could definitely set them up to operate in. But the most convincing thing I ever saw was the demonstration in Getz's basement. I think I told you about that.
Mm-hmm.
Where he actually set one of these utrons into its high spin mode and produced a vortex which filled the entire room. And I mean, there was electricity flying all over the place. Now, I've worked with, Cockcroft-Walton voltage multipliers. I've worked with Van de Graaff machines. I've worked with linear accelerators and high voltage transformers and voltage doublers and all kinds of things. And I've never, ever seen the effects that occurred in that man's basement. I mean, there were sparks flying from things that had nothing to do with each other on far sides of the roof. It was really amazing.
And that happens with people all the time, too,
Well, that's true.
Now, I'm smelling a segue here to your Dynaflux. Are we at that point, or are we getting close?
We can dive in anytime you want to. I mean, essentially, I think the next thing I should do is describe what this machine does.
Well, before you do that, I'd like to describe what some of our sponsors do, if I can do that. And then we'll come back and we'll pick up where we left off, okay?
Absolutely.
All right, folks, you are listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com with our special guest, our Friday night guest, and our science advisor, Jim Murray. And we'll be right back after a couple of short messages. Don't go away.
A monthly 24-page newspaper in its ninth year of addressing issues that affect all freedom-loving Americans, is one of the few remaining newspapers courageous enough to print the truth. Concerned about the burgeoning national debt and the Orwellian police state growing up around you? Subscribe today. Only $25 for 12 monthly issues, the Idaho Observer prints what you need to know to be a fully informed American. Go to idaho-observer.com or call 208-255-2307.
HempUSA.org is now offering free shipping worldwide to better serve our customers. Our goal is to get these fine hemp products to you in the least amount of time so you can enjoy what the powder seeds and oil can do for you. HempUSA.org has a warning that the U.S. food supplies are dangerously low, and we urge you to protect your family with hemp storable foods today. Tomorrow may be too late. Call 908-691-2608 or visit HempUSA.org. This incredible food source is loaded with enzymes so your body can digest the food you eat. And it creates an alkaline environment where cancer can't grow and parasites cannot live, and brings funguses, viruses, and bacterial levels down and to a halt. Try our powder seeds and oil today. Call 908-691-2608 or visit hempusa.org. If the body has the proper nutrition, it will heal itself. Ask yourself, why does our government not allow this crop to grow in the U.S.? This product is also great for pets and animals. Call 908-691-2608 or go to hempusa.org today.
Well, partner, we got our pork and beans, we got our coffee, and we got this real nice campfire. Now all we need is the radio. Go get that radio so we can listen to BBS.
Guess what, boss? Got this here radio, but we ain't got no battery.
Well, I told you to buy some batteries yesterday, but you forgot to buy them today.
A man can only do so many things in one day. Go into town and get some for the both of us.
Go to him. Make my day.
Dadnabbit, you and your BBS radio.
Back with another segment of Evident Footprints and our special guest, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome back to the show. We were talking about, what were we talking about? We were talking about an hour, actually. getting ready to talk about a segue to your Dynaflux generator.
And, yeah, that's correct.
All this this discussion about energy is very, very interesting and very enlightening, and we could go off on any one of these topics and do a whole series of shows. When you were mentioning the shape of the utron, what was going through my mind was this unusual shape that you have behind how the Dynaflex generator actually works. And I've had the luxury of seeing your DVD, so the listening audience is at a disadvantage right now, but hopefully someday we can actually show the demonstration right over the web, which we have the capability of at BBS.
Yeah, that would be interesting. Well, I guess the best thing to do in order to introduce this concept, Don, would be to first give a little bit of insight into the way a normal machine works and why electric power is becoming so dear, and then use that as a stepping stone to introduce the actual machine itself. There is a rule or a law in physics known as Lenz Law, and there was a physicist by the name of Lenz. I forget his first name. I think it was Heinrich Lenz, and he made the observation that if a current-carrying conductor is immersed in a magnetic field, that a force appears upon that conductor, which attempts to move it in a direction opposite to the direction that you're trying to move it. So if you have a generating device, which essentially consists of loops of wire spinning in a magnetic field, as soon as a current is allowed to flow through these wires, forces appear which attempt to stall that motion. And in order to prevent that from happening, whatever your prime mover is has to supply an equal and opposite force to keep the thing spinning. And incidentally, in that arrangement right there lies the basis for the marriage between thermodynamics and electrodynamics, which may be very convenient from the standpoint of traditional engineering, but unfortunately it locks engineering students into the paradigm of, let's just call it standard linear power concepts, which if you really embrace without any question, almost assuredly prevents you from understanding the fact that there are other octaves of efficiency that can be explored if you're willing to depart from the norm. So what does Dynaflex do? Well, interestingly enough, it's a very complicated machine. And I appreciate the fact that you keep calling me the inventor of this concept. But to be real honest with you, it was given to me in the form of a vision, literally. And I mean, I'm not a holy man. I'm not any kind of saint at all. So it's not a religious experience. You know, it was some kind of inspiration which definitely came from a source outside myself, and I'm not afraid to mention that. But anyway, it has taken me years to understand what this, let's call it an inspiration, means. And essentially, the geometry associated with this machine is such that it causes a right angle shift, or the way it's normally referred to would be an orthogonal shift, in the motion of the flux with respect to the rotation of the rotor. And as a result of that, what happens is Lenz law still operates. There isn't anything you can do that I know of to alleviate that situation. But the resulting force, instead of acting as a brake on the rotating member of the generator, winds up supplying a thrust, which is parallel to the axis of rotation. And so the strange thing about it is that the lens reaction now becomes a strain on the bearings as opposed to a braking action on the rotor. And the result of this, of course, is that once you have paid for the windage, friction, and other normal losses associated with the machine, which all generators have, you don't have the burden of supporting this enormous braking force. And so you wind up with efficiencies which are just off the map. And, you know, I have been struggling for years to get people interested in this concept because, you know, to engineer it properly and turn it into a viable source of power is not going to be cheap. It's going to require millions of dollars. But the thing I run into all the time is the same repetitive and unfortunate response where you might find a capitalist who's interested in investing in this because he sees the possibilities of putting a machine like that on the market. But he doesn't know anything about electrical engineering or magnetics or Lenz law or any of these things. So he turns to an engineer in his employ for guidance. And the guy will say, well, you know, these things are totally impossible. You can't have these type of hyper efficiencies. You know, it's a daydream. It's not real. And
yeah.
As a result of that, the guy usually says, well, you know, I'm sorry, but I don't understand it. And the people that are I've hired to be my technical experts advise against it. And so nothing ever happens. So what's happened as a result of continuous experiences of that type is that I have slowly put my own money into this over a period of 30-some-odd years and have gotten to the point where I'm getting some pretty amazing results at this stage of the game. And finally, there seem to be some people interested in doing something with this. But what's really amazing is I have found so many engineers who will promptly tell you that it's a total impossibility to do anything this radical in the field of electrical engineering. And yet, when you really quiz these guys, they don't even know how a normal generator works. So here they are accepting this other device totally on faith, but because they're so well programmed by the system, they can assure you that your machine can't possibly work simply because somebody said that you can't achieve those types of results. And it's a real interesting lesson, not so much in physics, but in human nature, Doug.
Well, Tesla had the same problem, didn't he? Especially with Thomas Edison.
Oh, well, Tesla had so many problems with Thomas Edison, and they weren't all technical either. A lot of them had to do with business and being cheated out of money is rightfully due to him and all those type of things, as you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've seen your demonstration. It's quite compelling, and where you have a generator performing a task, and then you have and we're saying a standard generator. And then you put your generator, you attach it to the same load, and like you said, it's off the charts. The performance is amazing. And you're using equipment that's measuring what you're doing so someone can see it. And even the people that were watching it, I don't think they understood what they even saw, to tell you the truth.
Well, I'll tell you something that is pretty amazing, and it's along similar lines. Back in the 80s, shortly after I got my patent on that, and that was an experience in its own right, I'll tell you. Someday we'll talk about the experiences I had with Washington trying to push that patent through. But anyway, back in the 80s when I received that patent, the next thing I was trying to do, of course, was to raise some money to put the thing into a commercial venue of some sort, and I had a lot of trouble, of course, as you realize, but eventually I was introduced to a group that was associated with the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia. And I was invited to go down and give a presentation, which I did. And they were very impressed, which actually astounded me. But anyway, they gave me, I believe, my memory serves, a grant for $25,000. And what they wanted me to do with that money was to build a better prototype than the one that I had, because the one that I had was really built on a shoestring. And it was actually made up in Michigan in that little shop I had with Vern Conkle. But I took the challenge, and with the help of a friend of mine who's become a lifelong friend and associate in these investigations, we built the model that you actually saw in the DVD.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing was that one of the conditions of getting this money was that I had to work in conjunction with a bona fide electrical engineer associated with a major university. Well, I didn't know anybody that fit that bill in those days, at least not in the East. I knew a couple of guys in northern Michigan in Lake Superior State College, but they weren't about to be of any use to me out in the New York area. So they were very happy to introduce me to a guy who was the head engineer at the Moore School of Electrical Engineering in Philadelphia. I don't remember his name right now, but he was a pretty nice guy. And he said, oh, I'm happy to work with you. This is a very unusual concept, very interesting machine. I've never seen any kind of a geometry like that, you know, employed for the purpose of generating electricity, yada, 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 yada. So we kept correspondence, and he visited the lab and the workshop several times, and finally the machine was ready to be tested, and he said, okay, here's what we're going to do. He said, I want all these instruments involved. They're all going to have be traceable back to NBS standards. They've all got to be recently calibrated, and he made sure that everything fit the bill 100%. And then he said, and you guys, meaning me and my friend who helped me build it, are going to operate as my assistants. I'm going to run the test, so nobody can say that you had any opportunity to do anything unusual. If we get unusual results, he said, I'll be able to verify under oath, if necessary, that that was the case. I said, that's fine. I have no problem with that. So he connected up the variable load to the output of the generator. We started it up, and he had a clipboard there with a bunch of paper on it. And on the top of the clipboard was a little calculator kind of built into the board. And every once in a while we're changing the power settings and whatnot, and he was taking data, he would crunch some numbers. And then he would scribble the results in the margin so that he had a kind of an ongoing mathematical view of how the machine was performing. I would imagine that we were about halfway through the whole scenario, and he stopped and he looked at me and he said, wait a minute. He said, this machine puts out more power than it takes to run it. And I said, yeah, of course it does. That's why you're here. Oh, he says, wait a minute now. He says, that's absolutely impossible. He says, therefore, it must be doing something else. Oh, I said, really? Well, what do you think it's doing then? He said, I don't know. I'll have to get back to you on that. Well, that was around 1989 or 1990, and I'm still waiting. I haven't heard from him.
My goodness. It's amazing that it's just ignorance, isn't it? I mean, it's is it ignorance or stupidity, or a little bit of both?
Actually, I've come to the conclusion that it isn't anything quite that drastic. I think it's something more powerful. It's fear. For some reason, people are terrified if they believe that they have the world organized in their mind in a certain way, and they're very comfortable within that paradigm, and they think they have everything accounted for and everything figured out. If something comes along to threaten that arrangement, a tilt sign comes on in their head. I'm serious. It just paralyzes them, and they're more afraid that you might have something than they are of anything else, because they don't want to say, they don't want to admit to themselves, well, gee, I have a PhD. It took me 20 years to get it, or whatever the amount of time is. If this guy's right, it means that I wasted all my time. Well, I don't really understand that line of reasoning, because I always thought that science was the pursuit of truth, regardless of consequence. And I've come to find out over the years that that's absolutely not true. There, with the exception of organized religions, there's nothing more prejudicial on the face of the earth than science. And to break into the hallowed halls of science with a completely new concept is perhaps one of the most difficult things imaginable.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter.
I go
doesn't
through the same
if it
thing.
Works or not.
I'm going through the same issues with people when we're describing using sacred frequencies as tuning centers for the reproduction of music or just the production of music. People will give you a million reasons why it's not valid, yet they'll tell you other things. A perfect example would be that I'll say, for instance, somewhere along the line chose 440 hertz as the international tuning standard. And as they're manufacturing musical instruments, they're all supposed to comply with that frequency. Well, that would mean all instruments would be in tune with each other, which is not a bad thing. But why would they pick 440 hertz? And my argument has always been that it's a very structured frequency, that it represents something numerologically, mystically, to those that are behind pushing for 440 hertz. And there's no other reason except the control that it creates, or the matrix that it creates. And I'll explain why the sacred numbers are sacred and how they operate and how they're really in tune with nature, and that this 440 hertz frequency is not right. And then I'll get something like, well, there are orchestras that tune at 442 hertz and 443 hertz. What is wrong with that? The point is the value of the number is the whole point. And what the number represents in terms of the totality of the cosmos. These sacred numbers are that because they're in tune. They're resonant. They're harmonious. They're not dissonant, and they're definitely not, anti-life. Let's put it that way. So I get into these discussions, and then it's, well, that can't be. I mean, you have to give me some other kind of proof. I don't have to give anybody any proof, really. Those people that have an open mind and are willing to listen to the music in that frequency all remark that it actually makes them feel better. There's something else that's going on that they can't explain, but they know that the music is more resonant with them. Well, it's compatible, let's say, with who they are as a human being, and with a mind and a soul. So we get into these. It doesn't matter what kind of application when you're talking about, let's say, unorthodox methods for trying something in a different way, especially if it's using sacred numbers. Look at the power in the pyramid. look what pyramids can do because of their measurements, because of their specific parameters, and they use sacred numbers. They use unending decimals.
Yep.
So you know, I'm just going along with what you're saying there. It's everywhere.
Well, it's everywhere, all right, but the thing that's really a shame about it is that the human response to new knowledge is the greatest impedance to the progress of humanity, and yet that's what they're all clamoring for. It's really kind of crazy. I remember an experiment that was done in Rhine University, I think it was back in the 30s, that had to do with the interplay between the memory of information, or in other words, information stored in memory, and information delivered cognitively by the senses, and that under certain circumstances, the sensory channels are disbelieved, simply because mm-hmm. of the fact that there is something already stored in memory which seems to be contradictory. And the test that they did to exemplify this was so strikingly simple that it was mind-boggling. They put an ad in the paper looking for people to assist in a psychological testing, and they requested individuals who are familiar with card games like Canasta and Bridge and Poker and things of that sort. And all these avid card players showed up, you know, assuming that there was going to be some extraordinary test and they were going to be involved in something really unusual. Well, actually they were, but they didn't know that. And they didn't realize it because it was so simple. They had a little machine that essentially you put a whole deck of cards in there and the machine would scrape the top card off the deck and flip it up for the observer to see it. And then I guess the card would drop back down somehow, and the thing would then pick up another card and show it to the observer. And it would do this at a fairly good clip, like as if a person was flashing, you know, cards. It's, what do they call those? The cue cards or something. Mm-hmm. And at any rate, the observer was supposed to simply sit there and watch this display and write down what cards he was shown. And every card player said, well, this is ridiculous. You know, there's no way we can't possibly get this right. We're so familiar with the cards. But unbeknownst to them, in the deck were hidden pseudo suits. In other words, cards that don't really exist. Like, for instance, a red 10 of clubs, or a black, you know, a black
king of diamonds.
Yeah, there you go, a black king of diamonds. So anyway, stuff like that. And they would be flipping along, you know, with these ordinary cards and just writing down the results as quickly as possible. And then all of a sudden, when one of these pseudo suits was shown to them, the reaction was unbelievable. Some people would say, oh my God, I can't see that card. I can't see it. And other people would say, oh, that card isn't that mysterious? That card is changing from black to red, or red to black. And all these off-the-wall kind of results that you would never anticipate. And yet you get some jerk off the street who doesn't know anything about cards, and you put him in there, and he just mumbles, oh, yeah, it's a red 10 of clubs. So what? You know. So The conditioning of the mind can actually interfere with legitimate information being presented by the senses. And it also reminds me of a story, and I don't know if it's true or not, but it's interesting to repeat, that when Christopher Columbus first arrived on the shores of the New World with these three giant boats, that the Native Americans were in such a state of shock that they couldn't see the ships at first. And it was only when the children saw the boats and pointed them out that the adults admitted that there was something really bizarre had just entered their realm of reality. Now, I don't know if that's a true story or not, but I can see the parallels. I can imagine how something like that might happen. So it's a really strange thing that the mind, which allows us to invent and create and do all these interesting things, also is the greatest inhibiting factor to the acceptance and utilization of new information. It's very strange.
Mm-hmm. So now you're going through this type of situation with this professor who's been assigned as part of your grant agreement to basically supervise and maintain the integrity of all the testing, and the guy bails out on you. What does that say about everybody? It doesn't seem like it's just the investors. If you can't substantiate it, it would seem to me that there has to be another avenue that one could approach this.
Well, there is, and basically what it's like is this. I have spoken to so many people about this, and don't forget, a lot of years have gone by, too. And what has come to light is that there's two main approaches. Well, there's actually three. The third one is the least attractive, because that means I have to live long enough to eventually do all this myself and get it out there without any assistance, and that's highly unlikely. But ignoring that option, the other two are, you can find a way to convince academia that this is a real thing and that somebody should take notice of it, and point out also that I'm not the only person that has stumbled onto this type of information. There have been many others. Or the other thing is not to worry about convincing anybody how it works. What you want to do is find somebody with deep pockets who doesn't give a darn how a thing works, and he wants to turn it into a product. And he comes along, makes an investment, and you get a product out there and actually start doing something with it. And then, 10 years later, the eggheads will say, hey, maybe we should look at that. But there's problems with that, too, because the investment climate in the United States in the last 15 or 20 years has really, really been stiff. And what seems to be the prevailing wisdom now is that if something looks as if it has too much risk associated with it, ignore it. And so what's happening is people are investing in McDonald's and what's the guy name with the chicken, Colonel Sanders, and all this type of stuff, because it's a safe investment. Everybody's going to stuff their face with hamburgers and chicken, we already know that. So there's no real risk. Whereas, the other contraption is something which, it sounds terrific, but until it's ready to go, a lot of people are not going to really be serious about investing in it. And what does that do? It puts the burden back on the original investigator to say, well, okay, that means I have to find a way to bring this to the next level of development on my own. And so if it's all well and good if you have a rich uncle who doesn't mind putting up a few $100,000, but if you're like most normal people, you've got mortgages to contend with, you've got kids going to school, you've got other bills to pay, you've got to sustain your family, you've got two or three cars you have to pay off, you've got gasoline, which is now completely out of sight. And all these things prevent most people from doing a lot of tinkering or even serious investigations on their own. And it appears to me that that's exactly what the establishment wants. Mm-hmm. They don't want any of this. They don't want anything new. They're very happy wallowing in what they've created. So,
well,
an interesting challenge, Tom.
Yeah, I'm wondering, based on what you think, or what you might, and I'm not asking you for a figure, but based on what you think it would cost someone to own a Dynaflux generator and the amount of money they would save over time. How long do you think it would take to pay for itself without really quoting a figure, knowing what electrical prices are? Let's say if someone wanted to run the electricity in their home on one of these.
Well, I think it would take less than 3 years to pay itself off, but that's somewhat of a guess because, the biggest problem I have right now is not proving that the concept is correct, but making sure that nothing changes as you scale it up to larger and larger sizes. And that's a luxury which I've only been able to do on paper simply because of the fact that, nobody has been willing to invest in an idea that is going to be fairly expensive to commercialize.
Mm-hmm.
But they forget that all the electric motors in the world, which we take for granted, I mean, you can go into any hardware store or electrical supply house and you can order motors from Granger and I forget what all the different names, Emerson, all these different companies. And, they're right here, so many horsepower, so many RPM, such a voltage, so much current, single phase, three phase, whatever. People are so used to that concept that they don't realize that enormous amounts of engineering went into getting these devices to the point where they are simply numbers in a catalog. I mean, it's just unbelievable how much effort and expense, was exerted between the time that Nikola Tesla banged together his first prototype in 1888 and the current situation where you can walk into a Granger Depot and order, an electric pump motor or a compressor motor, and you don't have to worry about it, and there's millions of them. It's not like you have to wait. They're everywhere. So to reach that point, takes teams of engineers and millions of dollars in capital expense and tens of thousands of hours of testing and adjusting until everything is optimized. That all has been done. Now the problem is you come up with something that's really new and interesting. It's fine that it's a benchtop model and it exhibits all these interesting characteristics and it blows the socks off of people who see it. But that's a long, long ways from actual commercialization. And the interesting thing about it is I told you the interaction that I had with that investment group on Wall Street.
Yes.
And how they tried to steal the invention from me back in the 80s. And I think that after all the dust settled on that, these guys are pretty intelligent, even though they have reptilian brains. And the conclusion they probably came to was they know all this. They know exactly how much effort it takes to bring something from the prototype stage to the mass production stage, where it can be a major force on the market. And they probably came to the conclusion, well, he's not going to get anywhere with it. And so far, they've been correct. I mean, it's been an uphill battle that hasn't resulted in anything, except I've learned a lot, but other than that, I mean, nothing extraordinary has happened.
Yeah, and for the listening audience out there that's not familiar with the story, without going into a lot of details, it was a big piece of the pie for them and a smaller piece for you just to get capital to keep the project moving forward. It's that story, follow the money. And it was more a vehicle for them to get more money into their hands, regardless of what you were doing. it's preposterous what they offered you. And that's not how normal business is done. That's the ripoff right there. It's like everything else.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about it was the money was supposed to come out of pension funds, and apparently, from what I learned during the exposure with this group, who I won't bother to mention, but they're associated with some pretty big banks. There are apparently two types of investments made, so supposedly on behalf of the pension funds. And one of them is the blue chip investment, where they go ahead and take X number of $1 million out of a pension fund, and they invest it with something like, let's say, AT&T or General Electric, you know, when there was a General Electric. And, you know, they know that there's going to be a steady return from that kind of investment, albeit small, it's going to be a steady return. And the opposite approach is that under certain circumstances, they're allowed to take a certain portion of that money from the pension fund and do speculative investing, where there's a high risk associated with the investment, but there's also the potential for a high rate of return. And so what they had proposed to do with the Dynaflux technology was to take $25 million out of a pension fund and use it supposedly to develop this technology. But the interesting thing was they had the cards stacked completely in their favor. What they might have thought they were messing around with an absolute imbecile. But the fact of the matter is that their intention was so clear that I didn't play the game. What they basically did with this $25 million was they set up a they intended to set up a corporation. They were going to have golden parachutes and retirement packages for all of the principals, not including me, of course, company cars, a meeting facility in the Poconos, and God only knows what else, salaries, all kinds of stuff. And when you did the numbers, out of that $25 million, there was $7.5 million allocated to the actual development of the technology. So I turned around and said to the guys, say, listen, you know, I see some problems here. It's all very well and good. You want to feather your nest. But I said, I know from the fact that I've been doing this work for so long and the fact that I wrote the business plan that $7.5 million will not be enough to commercialize this device, although it will take it a long way towards its perfection. I said it won't get the job done. That's the reason why I asked for the $25 million in the first place. And the response to that was, oh, you have nothing to worry about. Go ahead, get started with your development work, hire the people you need, take it as far as you can, and when you need more money, come and see us again. And I said, really? And I said, and how much equity do I have to give up the second time around? And they said, oh, well, that's completely negotiable. And I said, listen, fella, I was born and raised in Jersey City, New Jersey. I said, there's hustlers on every corner. I said, I can see through this, you know, if I was 6 years old. I said, I'm not going for it. And, boy, there was an explosion in that boardroom like you wouldn't believe. Because they realized that I understood the game, you know. But I would wind up with nothing or next to nothing, and they would wind up not only with all the money, but controlling the technology. So maybe I made the wrong decision in the sense that at least somebody would have it, and it would probably be further along had I played the game. But every fiber in my soul just said, don't take this deal. And I didn't. I walked out. And, of course, I can still hear the guy yelling down the hallway after me, nobody walks out on me. So I walked out on him anyway.
Yeah. Well, you know, they weren't taking a risk with their money. They were gambling someone else's money, that
of
pension
course.
Fund.
That's right.
And it was going to be in the red from the beginning.
Oh, yeah, there was no way it was going to go back in there. You know that.
Or, you know, I mean, there's the chance that it could, but you would lose total control. Maybe the second time around, you know.
Yeah, when I came back to the wishing well for a second infusion.
Yeah. So imagine how many thousands of times this is done probably every day in some area.
It's unbelievable. As a matter of fact, they've got it honed to a science, because I have a relative in the family, I'm not going to mention any names, who went into Wall Street as an understudy to a big brokerage firm. And I remember approaching him when he was first accepted and telling him, hey, listen, if you get situated in there and there's any way that we can raise some decent money to promote this technology, let me know. Well, I think he stayed with them about 2.5 years. And all at once, to my total surprise, he quit his position with that firm, and he went and got a job as an electrician in Kennedy Airport. And I questioned him on the issue, and he said, Jim, I'm not making anywhere near the money, but he said, I can sleep at night. He says, that whole operation in Wall Street is designed to scam you one way or another. And he says, you know, what they'll do is they'll take in an idea, they'll generate a corporation under it, they'll run that, you know, they'll make a big stock sale and run the prices up real high, and then they design the whole thing to collapse in such a way that all of the original investors are out of the picture, and then the core group, which is always in control of the situation, gets control of the idea or ownership of the idea, and they restructure it, and they all make a fortune, and the original people don't even have anything to say about it. They all go home with losses.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you have to be nuts to invest in the stock market, but that's only my opinion.
Yeah. They did something like that on 9/11.
Yeah, there was a lot of inside trading based on that whole thing, even in the airlines.
Mm-hmm. Well, it would be interesting. Now, for just as an overview for people, we're talking about a device that has the ability to put out a lot more power than it's taking in. In other words, if you consider what it costs to run a generator, I mean, a generator does what it does, and when it runs out of, if it's a gasoline generator, when it runs out of gasoline, it stops. And you have a device that has the capacity to put people in the black, so to speak, and build up upon itself, which is not the same thing as free energy, but obviously if you can store the energy that it's producing while it's running, you're ahead of the game.
Well, actually, what it does is even simpler than that. I mean, it's hard to envision if you're not a student of power, but basically, if we go back to the fundamentals, it helps a great deal in understanding this, because, you know, most people, as soon as they think about stuff like that, they freak out, and that's basically the end of the situation. Ironically, I was talking to an engineer just today who informed me that I was an idiot because he couldn't grasp what I was saying, so I'm the idiot. But anyway, if you revert back to some fundamental issues like conservation of energy theorem, which is almost worshipped as a sacred cow, it's quoted all the time. People say, oh, energy can neither be created nor destroyed. Well, actually, that's not what it says. What it says is, energy can neither be created nor destroyed, but only transformed from one type of energy to another. And the interesting thing about it is, that's not all it says either. Because if you dig into the textbooks deeply enough, you find out that there is no limit placed on the number of transformations that can occur. For instance, if we had a system that was 100% efficient, I could take a certain quantity of mechanical power and change it to electrical power. Then I could take and change that electrical power into thermal energy. Then I could change that thermal energy into optical energy. Then I could change it into acoustical energy, and then back into electrical energy, and reverse the whole chain of events. And I could keep that up all day long. The problem is that, of course, nothing is 100% efficient. And so every transformation winds up dissipating some of the energy. But be that as it may, the way things function now is that they take a charge of power from a source, let's say the grid, you know, just as an example. They do something with it, and then they consider that used, and they toss it away like a snotty tissue.
Mm-hmm.
All right? But the concept that I've been working on, which Tesla advocated 100 years ago, was you make this transformation with a high degree of efficiency into another form of energy, and then the original volume of energy that you're working with is now in a different form. And so the original type of energy there's nothing polluting its gradient. So you can literally transform it back to what it was before. And when you do that, it represents a change in the flow or the direction of the movement of this power. And that's where the term oscillating power comes from, because the power is literally reversing its direction of flow, and it's doing so under the laws of resonance, not frequency resonance, but energy resonance, which is a different animal altogether. And when you accomplish this task, what happens is that original quantum or volume or whatever you want to call it of energy that you started with is used over and over and over and over and over again until it's completely gone. And if you add up the work done in each successive transformation, it's a lot bigger than the work that's done when you take one slug of energy, use it for one time, and then chuck the remainder. And so it isn't like you're creating anything. It isn't like you're violating anything. You're actually using the law to its fullest extent.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, anybody that has the gumption to check the physics books can find out that when Maxwell wrote his original equations describing the transmission of energy by means of electric and magnetic fields, he did a whole series of experiments prior to that in which he was trying to determine whether or not electromagnetic energy was the only means of transformation of energy from source to load, or if it's possible that there was another unknown carrier involved, such as some kind of particles or something like that that operated mechanically within the conductors in addition to the fields. And he couldn't find evidence of that. So he went on the assumption that there was no such phenomenon. And later, Einstein, the Einstein, and de Haas, another physicist, proved that electricity has inertia, momentum, mass, all of the characteristics associated with gross matter. But even though they proved that and mentioned that the volume of energy associated with that mechanical aspect is significant, nobody ever went back and rectified the Maxwellian equations. The only one that took advantage of the whole situation was Tesla, because he realized that the real energy associated with this stuff is in the momentum of the charge carriers. And a lot of this work was done long before Thomson discovered the electron. So it's not like They knew exactly what was carrying the power, but they hypothesized the existence of this other entity. And the only reason why Maxwell didn't make these measurements himself was because he was using such minute quantities of electricity that the forces were imperceptible. And it took about 30 years for the instrumentation to improve to the point where Einstein and de Haas could detect this stuff. And maybe they thought it wasn't significant enough to modify the original laws. But what Tesla did was he said, well, heck, if I capitalize on that by adjusting all my circuit parameters to maximize the effect, it's going to have an unbelievable result. So the point of talking about this is to simply say, I don't remember, or I don't even know if I knew what the actual percentage is that they attributed to this undetected quantity of power that's actually transmitted by the carriers as opposed to the field structures. But let's say that it's 20%, just to pick a number. It's probably more, because otherwise Tesla wouldn't have been excited about it. But let's just say that it's 20%. So that means that if we have a system that is designed solely on the belief that all the energy that's carried by that is resident in the field structures, and we use the epitome of that optimization as our standard for 100%. Anybody who comes along and says, hey, what about the energy of momentum associated with the current? What happens if we use that all of a sudden? Well, now you've got 120%. And that's something that can't be allowed. Doesn't matter if it's there or not. You know, the problem is that the entire system is set up to ignore any such thing. And so if you come up with any arrangement, doesn't matter what it is, that gives you an effect greater than that, then you're going to have problems. And the interesting thing too, Don, is that any device which generates electricity by means of coils inadvertently, but absolutely, will generate two types of electricity. One is going to be the KW component, which we are all familiar with, because it flows out of the generator and essentially winds up powering lights and heaters and motors and things of that sort. But there's another component which is generated by virtue of the fact that you have reactants inside your windings. And that's going to create a component which is reactive in nature. It's called a VAR. And this VAR component is looked upon as being incapable of doing any worthwhile work because it's usually out of phase with the voltage. But the interesting thing is, it's not out of phase with the mechanical forces that are associated with the movements of these conductors. And so what Dynaflux essentially does is it changes the relativistic perception between the kilowatt component and the reactive component in such a way that the kilowatt component is delivered to the load, and then the reactive component is sent back in the opposite direction as a force which winds up assisting the prime mover. And it assists the prime mover to such an extent that when you look at the efficiency curves of that machine, it actually compensates for friction windage and resistive losses when it's under load. So it's actually more efficient when it's loaded than when it's unloaded. And I'm not talking about the conversion efficiency. I'm talking about the inherent losses, which are normally taken as baseline losses that can't be circumvented. Mm-hmm. So it's a real phenomenon, and it's very interesting, and no one cares about it. So
while you're describing all that, I'm thinking of things that are in the realm of the work that I do, and one that pops up constantly is the issue of a power amplifier, and that it's putting out this power that's driving audio speakers, and yet it's doing it inefficiently, in that they have to have a heat sink in that device to dispel the increase in temperature that's occurring. What if that were to be transformed back into electricity? You could really, that concept could be applied to any electrical device, couldn't it? Or TV set.
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, Philo Farnsworth, who is attributed with the invention of the, I forget what they call it, the iconoscope, I think it's called, the tube that actually takes the TV image in the camera and converts it to electrical impulses. Before he died, he tried to patent a tube which was a true electrical amplifier. Now, in a normal amplifier, you have a very weak signal go in one side and a very powerful signal come out the other side, which is all well and good. But the reason why it works is because in the middle, there's an enormous reservoir of power that's supplied by an outside source. And that power essentially is used to increase the amplitude of the original signal so that you get the larger version of it reaching the speakers. Mm-hmm. But the kind of tube that he was talking about didn't require a power input to do this. So, you know, there have been many, many people who have stumbled onto actual arrangements in nature that exemplify this type of thing. I mean, Tesla's laboratory you mentioned was burned to the ground. The reason it was burned to the ground was he was actually creating a heat engine which ran off the latent heat in the atmosphere and produced electrical power as an output. Now, it ran off of liquid air, which, as you know, is like minus 212 degrees or something. I forget the temperature of it. But it's pretty darn cold. And so, essentially, he created a heat engine that ran off a cold boiler. And as a result of that, since the boiler was at a temperature below the ambient temperature, all the losses were negative, which is another way of saying that heat flowed into the engine for free. Now, in a normal arrangement where the boiler is hotter than the environment, what do you have? You have problems because heat flows out of the boiler into the environment, which is normal. It's always going to flow from the higher temperature to the lower temperature.
Yeah.
So here he had this engine perfected whereby you essentially would be running it off of the difference in temperature between the air and this liquid oxygen or liquid air or whatever it was he had in his boiler. Well, you know, even if it's 10 degrees below zero outside, you still have 200 and something degrees to work with. So it's an amazing device. And somebody must have said, well, that's a little bit too amazing. Let's burn down the building.
Yeah, I think it was in Colorado Springs when that occurred. Jim, we're out of time, unfortunately. This has been another amazing show. And, of course, we can always come back and revisit any one of these topics that we covered. But your Dynaflux generator is something that really deserves a fair shake. And with the hue and cry for new technologies, even though it's been around for some time, the principle is very sound, and it would ease this vice grip that the oil companies have on us, and the trickle down effect that it has on all the other types of energy that are presented to us as options. And And so, you know, hopefully someone is going to hear this show and say, you know, this sounds like something I'd like to be involved in. You never know.
No, you never do. And, of course, I'm always willing to do whatever it takes to go forward. You know that.
Yes. Well, I look forward to next week's show with you. I'm sure it'll be a good one. And this has been fascinating. I could go another 3 hours, but Seth will kill us. So we'll have to wait until next week. But you have a good weekend, and I look forward to our show next week.
No problem, Don. I'll be available as usual. You have a wonderful weekend, too.
All right. Thank you. Folks, you have been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. Our special guest this evening, Jim Murray, will be with us next Friday. So be sure to tune in, and also tune in to all the other shows on BBS Radio. We're here Monday through Friday at 10 p.m. Pacific, and we've got some great guests lined up in the coming weeks, so be sure to tune in again. Also, visit my website, directlightproductions.com. Read up on the Three Stooges Go to Washington. Part 3 is already posted, and Part 4, I'm told, should be ready within the next day. So I'm hoping to have that posted. Also, I've posted some printable versions of the Idaho Observer articles for those of you that want to see black ink on white paper. So I've had people try to print the white letters. It doesn't work on white paper. Got to use black paper for that. Anyway, special thanks to Don Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, and to Seth Hendrick for the sound tonight. And wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.